Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit credit union with 21 branch locations and a full suite of digital services, inviting listeners to recognize and appreciate the contributions of Washington State's dedicated public employees during the month of May. More information at WSECU.org.
The very first time I got on stage, I wrote my set list on a 3x5 index card. I wrote the date of the gig, which was September 4th, 1984, and I put Comedy Underground, Seattle, Washington, and then I kept it because the next week I came back and I wrote another set list on another card, and I didn't start out to do this. I'm not OCD, but I kept those first five or six or seven, so every night I would, before I walked on stage, I would write my set list on a 3x5 index card. It's 34 years later. I have every show I've ever done catalog, and now I have 6,000 of them.
Hey, it's Gabriel Spitzer here with Sound Effect, and this is comedian Brad Upton.
There they are. That's every show. This starts right here in 1984. So every time I get to 50, I put a rubber band around them and they go in the drawer. So I have a few others. Well, then my last show was Saturday night in Chehalis. I did the historic Chehalis Theater, so that was my last one. But I can pick out anywhere and tell you where I was, what night, what material I did. I don't know. Look at this. 3/30/94. I was at the Improv in Cleveland, Ohio. There's my set list. What's weird is I told my kids, I don't know what you, I know when I die, you're just going to toss them. But to me, it's like, oh, it's everything I've ever done. I want them to sit down and look at every one of them.
Those 6,000 cards mark a 34-year-long comedy career. It often takes people years to break in as a working comic. You plow through rejection and crummy gigs until you can barely scrape out a living, but that is not what Brad Upton did. Instead, he killed it on his very first set and never looked back. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is beginner's luck, people who hit pay dirt on practically their first try.
Make them laugh. Make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son. But be a comical one. They'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Or you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite. And you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat.
So let's hear the story of Brad Upton, the working comic whose career turned on his very first stage appearance. It began when Brad was working a very different kind of job, far away from a big city comedy scene.
Well, I had wanted to do stand-up for several years. I first had that dream or that idea in college, but I didn't know how to or where to. So that was the late 70s, and I lived in Pasco, Washington, teaching fourth grade. I didn't know what to do, so I just bought the Seattle Times, and I would always read comedy on certain nights. I could see the entertainment listings, and they had an open mic in there. So I knew there was an open mic in Seattle on Tuesday night. So I decided I wanted to do it, but I was too chicken. So for 4 or 5 years, I wrote material, and then I finally went, I'm not getting any younger. I got to go try this. And then I drove over in September of 83, signed up, and about three people before I was going on stage, I chickened out. And I just walked out of there, and I drove home and waited for a year. And I just hated myself that whole year. Just hated that I had gotten that close and then chickened out. The very first time when I actually got on stage, my dad owned a car rental franchise. So I was constantly going for him, even when I was in high school and college and post-college. I would go retrieve rental cars for him. So I told only two people that I was going over to Seattle to try this open mic. I told my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and I told my dad, and he goes, hey, I got a car over in Seattle, Firebird, Super Sport. Why don't you fly over there on Horizon and grab it and then go do that open mic, and then you can drive it home. I went, perfect. So I flew over to Seattle, and I got this rental car at SeaTac, and I drove to the Comedy Underground and went on stage for the very first time. Well, in the 80s, comedy was so hot. Tuesday night at the Comedy Underground in 1984, it was almost full. The audience was good. I mean, you just go to an open mic now and you can't imagine it being like that. But the audience was really good and the comics were doing very well. And the MC brought me up And the first joke got a laugh, and I just kind of relaxed. And then I delivered all the jokes, and I got big laughs right where I thought they'd be. Punchline, punchline, 5 minutes. And I was walked off stage. I couldn't have felt any better because it had gone much better than I'd anticipated. And Laura Crocker, who was the godmother of comedy around Seattle, she had a bunch of one-nighters, and she was one of the producers of the Seattle Comedy Competition. And she walked up to me and she said, "That was great. We want you to be in the competition." And I just didn't understand at all what she meant. I go, "I don't understand. Is this open mic?" She says, "Yes, it is, but it's also the last night of auditions for the Seattle Comedy Competition, and you passed." I go, "Oh, great. What does that mean?" And she goes, "Well, it starts next Tuesday night here. We want you back here next Tuesday night." And she said, "There's 20 comedians. You're competing for money." And she explained it to me. I said, "Okay, so I'm supposed to be back here next Tuesday night." And I walked out of there thinking, "Oh, man, I am the best comic. I am so good. I am so good. And then I'll probably be on The Tonight Show in about 3 weeks." I was thinking, this is September. By Thanksgiving, I'll probably be on Johnny Carson by Thanksgiving. That's what I'm thinking in my head, you know. When I got off stage, I picked up this Trans Am with a 351 supercharged, just a muscle car, one of the last muscle cars out of Detroit. And at the time, the Mount Baker Tunnel, there was just two tubes, narrow tubes that went through to get on the floating bridge. And my dad had told me way back when he was in high school in the 1940s, they used to drag race through that tunnel because you couldn't get caught. So as I approached the tunnel, I'm just as high as I can be as far as feeling good about myself. And it had been raining, and you know the roads are rutted from all the studded tires, and there was puddles and stuff. So I just stomp on it. I'm going to go through this tunnel at about 130. I don't care. I'm just going to romp on it and go through here as fast as I can in this Trans Am. And I stomped on the gas, and I went from 40 up to about 70, and the car just turned sideways on me. Completely hydroplaned and went to the right. And I yanked the wheel and turned it all the way left. I was just fishtailing across both lanes. And I knew at that point I was going to wreck the car, but I just thought, God, I hope I can walk away from this because I'm going to wreck this thing badly. And I slid into the tunnel sideways and hit that dry pavement, and I straightened it out, and I didn't hit anything. And I was like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh. It occurred to me as I was sliding, that was the shortest career ever. So in 20 minutes, I'd had the highest high of my life, and I literally thought I was going to die 20 minutes later. And I just locked on that steering wheel to the top of Snoqualmie Pass. Then I came back the following Tuesday. I got off work in Pasco at 3 o'clock. I walked the fourth graders out to the school bus, and I jumped in my car, and I drove to Seattle back to the Comedy Underground the following Tuesday night. But now I'm in with 20 professionals, and it's my second time on stage. And the audience is seeing 20 people that were way better than the people that went up the previous Tuesday at my open mic, and I sucked. I was like, "Oh, what happened?" I mean, the exact same set, the same jokes, but the audience can tell the difference now. So, the first three nights then, I drove from Pasco over to Seattle, do my set, drove back to Pasco, taught school, drove back. I commuted for 3 days. So I was sleeping about 3 hours a night, and I finished 18th out of 20. But the cool thing was that I made a bunch of contacts. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, I was around a bunch of professionals, and because I'd been in the comedy competition, I had some kind of credit. Oh, he was in the competition. And then when I came back over to Seattle, the next couple of months, I could do guest sets on professional shows because I'd been in the competition. So now, 32 years later, I do about 120 shows a year, and I make more money now than I ever have in my life. I have comics now asking me for advice, and they want to pick my brain about how to get started, and I literally tell them, "I don't know how you get started now. I don't know how you do it." Because the model has changed so much. Now there's all these open mics that don't pay anything. There's no place to start where you're getting paid enough to quit your job. I didn't know it at the time. I thought this is the regular career path you take. But if I'd have gone up the first time and ate it, that might have been the only time. I don't know if I'd have gotten back up there. But the fact that I got into that comedy competition the very first night I got on stage, and then I did six nights and hung around with people, that's beginner's luck right there.
Brad Upton is a stand-up comic living in Lake Forest Park. Thanks to Brett Hamill for his reporting on this story. Gabriel Spitzer here. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is beginner's luck. Getting something exactly right the first time is often not because of skill or natural talent. Sometimes it's just a fluke. When Seattle writer Margaret Friedman was 16 years old, she was an exchange student living with a family at their summer home in the middle of France. And one afternoon, a combination of curiosity and boredom led her to do something she never thought she was capable of.
The village where they spent their summers was tiny, really tiny. It was a summer-only village, and it was composed of about 70 people, all of whom were related in some way to each other, and we'll call the family the Bellevilles. After a few weeks, my novelty wore off, and my French exchange sister had by then figured out how geeky I was and what a social liability it would be to hang out with me. So as this extraneous bit of DNA in their midst, it was hard to know what to do with myself or how to fit in. Socially, this village was quite interesting. Every night, one of the families hosted a soiree, which is a party that usually started in the middle of the afternoon and went on deep into the night. It usually involved cooking a whole animal and the preparation of numerous side dishes and desserts and seemingly endless informal chatting and hanging out and gossiping in the kitchen, at least for the women. As the days wore on, and the days were identical, more or less, I became a little bored of helping Madame Belleville prepare her various culinary offerings. And I would sneak off behind the barn to where the men in the village would be gathered, drinking pastis and shooting revolvers at paper targets fluttering on a clothesline way in the distance. So I took to sitting on a wall and watching them shoot. It's unlikely that any of their own girls would have gotten away with that, having this alien identity. They tolerated me sitting there and watching. But at a certain point, I realized I really wanted to shoot. I asked my French father, Monsieur Belleville, if I could take a shot. And he said, no, c'est pas pour des filles, it's not for girls. And so every time I would ask him for a shot, he would repeat the same mantra, and I got very frustrated with that. So at a certain point, I pulled out all of my horrible teenage gumption in all its assholery. And I said to him, Monsieur Belleville, it is obvious why you do not want me to take a shot. My last name is German, and everyone knows the Germans shoot better than the French. And as a little background, Monsieur Belleville had been in the French army as a high officer, and there was really nothing more mortally wounding that I could have said to him. But at that point, he blanched and handed me his revolver with no instructions and not a word of encouragement or otherwise. Somewhere in my calculations, I somehow thought a mini lesson would be involved. But after my rude ploy, clearly that was not going to happen. I had never held a gun before, and it was heavier than I thought, very unfamiliar, kind of big for my hand, and I wasn't even sure I'd be able to squeeze the trigger. Trembling, with no idea whatsoever whether the gun was cocked or how to cock it or how to hold it or anything, I shambled up to the shooting line and basically just held out my arm, clamped my eyes shut, and squeezed the trigger. My glasses fell off and I could barely keep the gun in my hand. The first thing I noticed was this shooting pain that went firing right up my arm. It was the recoil, which I hadn't expected, and it felt like the bullet had gone the wrong direction right up my arm. By the time I opened my eyes, these gentlemen were looking very nervous and upset. They were communicating wordlessly among themselves, and one of them was running forward with the piece of paper with the bullseye on it. And only two of the men had managed to shoot onto the paper that day. And then there was this other shot, and it was right in the middle of the bullseye. And they could only deduce that it was my shot. And clearly, this was not going over well at all. They were very upset. Prenez un autre! Take another shot, they demanded. I knew I had touched a terrible nerve, and I also knew that if I took another shot, any credibility, any little shred of honor that I could get away with would be gone. I tried to regain my composure as best I could, and I basically said to them, gentlemen, you insult me by asking me to take another shot. You offered me one shot, and I took it, and now I am going into the house. And off I went into the kitchen to help Madame Belleville with the profiterole making, where the guns shot nothing other than pastry cream. In terms of sheer luck, I always hoped I would never win anything small, like a raffle for a basketball or anything unimpressive, because I always had the feeling that I had one opportunity for winning, and I certainly didn't want it to be for a goldfish or something like that. So I think that shot might have been my big day for beginner's luck.
Margaret Friedman is a writer who lives in Seattle. That story was produced by Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're telling stories of beginner's luck. A few years ago, a group of teenagers in Washington State took on one of our most perplexing problems with a novel strategy. They sued the state government for failing to safeguard the climate for future generations. The tactic was new, the plaintiffs were young, and yet they won. A Superior Court judge ruled in their favor in 2016, and that's how climate change was solved. No, just kidding. Actually, nothing much happened after their victory. So now they're trying again, this time suing the federal government. 17-year-old Aji Piper has in some ways become the face of this effort. Now he gives talks and interviews all over the place, even though he's still a senior in high school. Aji and his mother Helena joined us in our studio, and he explained that the notoriety has been kind of a mixed bag.
I'd probably say everything good that I do is from the foundation that parents, or for me, my mom set. She hasn't like pushed me to do this activism. It's more like be active in your community and fight for the things you care about as like an always. Just like that's not even like this like special thing. That's like that is what you do.
But there's maybe another side to that. You gave this TEDx talk, and one of the little points that you made was that you said that your mom thinks that you worry too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really easy to stress out, to get anxious or depressed about climate change, and to worry about everything constantly, and that's too much. You have to sometimes take a step back and kind of zero in on the things you have steps to take and recognize that there is a bigger picture, but not to focus so hard on the bigger picture that you lose sight of what you can do.
Yeah. How do you feel about the attention that you've been getting and being in the spotlight the way you have the last few years?
It's a double-edged sword. That's how I feel about it. On one hand, you have a lot of power. You have the opportunity to have your voice be heard. On the other hand, you have so much attention on you, and I don't really like that. I don't really like everybody being like, so what is your business? What are you doing? Like, I like to have my privacy and nobody really be interested in my business.
What's it like for you, Helena, to see the notoriety that Aji gets? I mean, do you have the same kind of mixed emotions that he does?
Well, yeah, he's a private person. Aji's always been, he has this ability to be, you know, out and extroverted and dealing with people and really easily makes connection with people, but he has this like deep need to have his privacy in his space, and he's been through so much that that space is healthy. And so I'm like, yeah, you know, you have this gift and I don't want to see you turn away from that. But how do you balance that with also taking care of yourself? It's hard.
Your mom alluded to the fact that you've been through quite a bit, and understanding that I want to respect your privacy. But is there anything else you want to say about your backstory that speaks to the kind of resilience that you have developed?
I mean, I guess it's important to understand that I had a very abusive father and that my childhood was kind of in this traumatic situation. I think activism has kind of derived from that. When somebody's destroying something or fighting something or doing something unjust, I feel the need to stand up and be like, that's wrong. Action became a way of processing a lot of things. And then kind of, you know, stepping back into my personal life is kind of how I process my activism. Being able to like decompress. So it's kind of like this seesaw balance.
That's so, yeah. Really fascinating. We've talked a lot. Aji likes to keep those worlds separate. And he's very adamant about that. Sometimes I'm like, well, why don't you give a presentation at school? Or why don't you talk more about that? And he's like, I need to have my personal life, my school life be that. And then my activist self be that.
I've told her before that like I would go absolutely crazy, bat crazy, if I had to put all of it together and into one area. I don't think I'd be able to stop thinking about activism, and I think that would wear me out. I would be floundering around in like a sea of despair, basically.
Yeah, what would you rather be talking about with your friends on any given afternoon?
Just teenage nerd friend stuff, like the next Slay game or. The random stuff that pops into your head, the random conversations. Maybe we'll talk about for a couple hours the intricacies of why a woodchuck is called a woodchuck and how much wood it could chuck if it could chuck wood.
That's deep. Helena, was Aji one of those kids that asks why?
Oh yeah. He's always been incredibly explorative. Like I said, a deep thinker. I mean, he was like 2 years old walking around.
That's a deciduous tree. That's a coniferous
yeah.
tree.
Just talking about quantum physics. And
I also feel like it's easier to understand quantum physics when you're a kid because you can't even think about really what quantum physics is.
Well, you're probably right.
It's just like it melts your mind and you're just like, I'm good. Really, I'm not.
But wait, I think you're onto something there, because as a kid, you don't know the way that things are supposed to behave, right? And so when something kind of violates those rules, it doesn't set off alarm bells quite the same way it does for an adult. And I wonder if that's if there's something comparable there with big, seemingly insoluble problems like climate change. Like when you're old, you can sort of see all the barriers and despair of anything changing. And when you're young, you don't necessarily have that kind of structure in your way of thinking. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I experienced that throughout my life as an activist. You know, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We're in the dark on it. And sometimes we just need to run into a wall to understand where we are. And that's how I see it. It's like diving right into it. And I think that's how a kid would see it. Because the kid's not going to think about all these other possible problems, they're going to see the solution to the problem you've presented them. And any other things that are created off of that, you have time to deal with them. But climate change, we're running out of time to deal with it. Put yourself in that headspace of, I see the solutions and I don't see the problems. And then alter it a little bit so you see all the problems, but the solution is more important. So you do the solution, then you take the problems as they come.
Aji Piper is 17 and a senior at CareerLink High School based at South Seattle College. And Helena Piper is his mom. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about beginner's luck. And the next story involves a few beginners, a lot of luck, and a small, delicate creature called the island marble butterfly. Part of what makes it distinctive is this green, iridescent camouflage pattern on the underside of its wing, but you're more likely to see just a flash of white cruising by you on a gust of wind.
It's maybe 2 inches across. When you just see one fly by, you see mostly white. If you look at him carefully enough and get a good search image for him, you might see a little tinge of green or orange on the hind wings, but it's pretty faint.
That kind of sighting is extremely rare. In fact, for decades, this butterfly was thought to be extinct. The last sighting had been in 1908. That's until a curious man named John Fleckenstein happened to be in the right place on the globe at the right time. 88.5 Environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe tells us how the island marble butterfly was rediscovered and why being new to something can be a big advantage.
John Fleckenstein is a guy who likes action. Before he got interested in finding rare critters in the wild, he worked in theater. Here's how he describes what it takes to catch an island marble butterfly.
Well, they are funny flyers, and if you are trying to catch one to confirm an identification, you better be in pretty good shape because you're probably going to get some exercise. I have been lucky, taken one swing of the net and had them take a left turn when they should have taken a right and fly right into the net, but usually you have to chase them.
20 years ago, Fleckenstein was working for Washington State as a zoologist. He'd relocated from the Midwest. He was good at finding butterflies and was looking to get to know his new home in the Pacific Northwest. So he and a friend dreamed up a scheme to learn more. They decided they needed to do a systematic inventory of prairie butterflies. They set out to make a kind of catalog of all the butterflies that still called the Puget Sound home. They had both studied popular accounts from experts with descriptions of lots of different kinds of bugs that they wanted to know more about. John was really interested in the San Juan Islands, which, by the way, if you haven't been there, is kind of like paradise, with sweeping views of the Salish Sea from bluffs above sandy beaches, orca whales sometimes feeding offshore. You get the picture.
We went back out there, and we weren't finding the numbers they talked about, and even where the good prairie remnants were, we weren't finding the species diversity. So we thought there was some kind of problem. We didn't have a baseline, so Ann and I decided that we would establish whatever baseline we could.
Ann Potter still works for the state. She's a conservation biologist who specializes in insects. She wasn't actually with John in the field when he rediscovered the island marble butterfly, but if it weren't for Anne, it might not have been found. You see, John came back with lots of specimens. He didn't really know all of what he had. Two of them, which he had collected at American camp on the south end of San Juan Island, stood out to Anne.
My thoughts were, I don't know what this is. What is this? Usually when you work in a field, you know the animals that you're working with. And when you see something that you've never seen before, you can't put it in that box. You can't identify it.
Yeah, what is this thing?
What he had brought in looked really similar to several common white butterflies found in the region.
We were confused. We had no idea what it could be. I even thought that maybe his samples were mislabeled for a while because he'd also been working in eastern Washington where there's another subspecies. We ruled that out and it just quickly became mysterious.
Anne packed up the specimens and took them to a conference of butterfly experts in Corvallis, Oregon. As soon as they saw these two little butterflies laid out in front of them, they knew they were seeing the island marble, a species which had not been noted for 100 years.
The person that I shared the information with first practically had to scrape him off the ceiling. He was so blown away by seeing this butterfly that the general thinking was that it was extinct.
I was working in the yard that afternoon, and I thought I heard some screaming from Corvallis clear up to Olympia, because the experts there knew right away what they were.
Now, this doesn't happen every day. John Fleckenstein had found the proverbial needle in a haystack. But the thing is, those butterflies were all out there all along. It's just that no one else took the time and effort to look for them. John says keeping an open mind and being new to things has served him very well in his career.
Every time I start looking for a new animal, I really have to convince myself that I'm a beginner and go find all of the information that I possibly can. Yeah, Anne and I were beginners with prairie butterflies generally, and then we found the island marble, and we were absolute beginners with that.
I like to cultivate the sense of being a beginner. When you think that you know something, then you're closed off to learning. And if you already think you know all the answers, then you're not going to be effective.
Do you feel lucky to have found it?
Yeah. Just fabulously lucky. If I'd been 100 yards over to the east, I might not have seen it. If I'd been down at the beach, I might not have seen it.
Today, the island marble butterfly is known to exist only on the south end of San Juan Island, and the area that it flies around in totals just a few hundred acres. The actual habitat where it lays its eggs is only 5 or 10 acres, and most of that is on public land. Biologists estimate that the population in the wild recently dipped to just a few hundred. A big part of the problem, says Anne, who still surveys the area for the state, is the very dense population of deer. She's standing near the ocean with her binoculars, scanning a steep hillside for island marble butterflies. We didn't see any today. Mostly what she finds is their habitat, tall, spindly mustard plants with bright yellow tender buds, and some without them.
That plant on the right, there are no flowers on it. The plant still looks pretty healthy, but the end of every single branch or raceme that had a flower on it has been munched off, and that's where the island marbles would lay their eggs.
Today, the island marble butterfly is recognized as an endangered species. And because of its low numbers, a highly skilled workforce is paid to be like a nanny to the butterfly eggs. The biologist at American Camp, which is a national historic park, carefully plucks some of these eggs from the mustard blossoms before they're eaten by deer or bunnies, so that these eggs can be reared in a lab in the woods. Federal biologists watch over the eggs and study their development into caterpillars till they make their chrysalises. That's the butterfly's cocoon. Then after they emerge each spring inside mesh cages, those coddled adults are released into the wild. And all of the adult island marble butterflies only fly for about 5 or 6 days per year. And then they die. In the wild, those chrysalises can be in the landscape, invisible and vulnerable to trampling, for up to 10 months of the year. So saving them means restoring prairie habitat and protecting it from trampling. Why do we go to all this trouble for just a few hundred butterflies?
The island marble is a product of this environment. It's here because of this soil type. It's here because of this weather type. It doesn't occur anywhere else in the world. So it's kind of like a Mona Lisa that was created from this environment over thousands of years. So why wouldn't we care about this animal that is unique to this place?
Anne says whenever she's lucky enough to see one, that bright flash of spring green on its wings gives her hope for the future that one more generation has made it through.
That story from 88.5 Environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, you're listening to Sound Effect, and for our last story about beginner's luck, we turn now to one of those things that no amount of experience can prepare you for, your first child. Sylvana Clark is a speaker and author who lives in Bellingham. Almost 30 years ago, she was home with her husband and her infant daughter when she found herself in a life-or-death situation, desperately in need of a little luck.
So it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting in this comfortable rocking chair. I have my six-month-old baby in my arms, and I'm feeding her. And I'm thinking, you know, my life is perfect. I have a perfect child, and this should be like a Hallmark commercial because everything's so wonderful. There's just a little night light, and so I can see her eyes, and she's looking at me. And again, I'm thinking, oh, life is good. And then suddenly I feel this like a whoosh over my head. And then it comes back and it's this kind of whoosh. So I turn on this table lamp and I look around, and there on this lacy white curtain is a bat. And it's horrifying. And so I grab my baby and I scream and I run into where my husband is. And I'm screaming. I'm saying, there's a bat in the baby's room. Get it out. Get it out. So he jumps up and he says, well, listen, I'll just remove the screen from her window and then I'll swoop the bat to fly out the window. And that was great. So he's just getting ready to go in the nursery, and I scream really loud because I've looked down and there is blood all inside my baby's ear. And so the only thing I can think of is that bat has been sucking the blood out of my baby. So we change tactics, and he calls 911. And the 911 dispatcher says, well, you have to kill this bat. It has to be dead, and then you have it tested for rabies. But she said, make sure your entire body is covered, because bats that have rabies, they do strange things, and you don't know what's going to happen to you. So make sure your body is covered, but kill that bat. So my husband runs down to get his bat-killing clothes on. And I'm looking at my baby, and by now she's crying because she senses this tension, and she's screaming and screaming. And I'm sure there's foam coming out of her mouth. There wasn't, but in my mind, she was already encumbered with rabies. So my husband comes up. He has on these rubber boots. He has blue jeans. He has his ski jacket, and then garden gloves, and his motorcycle helmet with the visor down. And he yells, I hear him, he goes, I'm going in. Oh, and then he's holding his weapon of choice, which is a tennis racket. So he was going to kill the bat with the tennis racket. So he goes in the nursery, and I hear this banging. I hear a shelf fall down. I hear him tripping over things. And he comes out, and he says, "I can't do it. I can't do it. There's a baby bat attached to the big bat." So it got even worse. Well, just then, the phone rang, and it was someone from the health department who had been contacted by the 911 dispatcher, and he said, "Yes, you have to kill the bat so we can test it for rabies, but do not hit it because you can't damage the brain. That's how somehow they test for rabies. So the brain has to be intact." So he tells my husband, "Get a mason jar, a large mason jar, capture the bat in the mason jar, put the mason jar over the exhaust pipe of your car with the engine running, and in 20 seconds, the bats will be dead." So again, my poor husband runs down to the garage and he's looking for a mason jar. And this health department guy goes on, he says, "Silvana, your daughter's life is at stake. Your husband needs to meet me in 20 minutes at the Greyhound bus station, and we are going to ship the bats to my colleague who will test them for rabies. But we can't miss that bus, so don't be late." And so I'm thinking, you know, this is not a Hallmark commercial anymore. It's the Blair Witch Project. It was just horrible. So Alan comes up and he's holding up his mason jar and he runs into the nursery. And again, I hear things crashing around and there's things falling. And he comes out and he's triumphantly, he holds up this jar and there's two bats in it. And he has it covered with a copy of Goodnight Moon. And he runs down. And so I start to relax because I'm thinking, you know, in 20 seconds, the bats will be dead. He'll make it just in time to the Greyhound bus station, and at least we'll know what the next step is. So I look at the clock on my nightstand, and 1 minute goes by, and then 2 minutes goes by, and there's no car leaving, and then 3 minutes, and then 4 minutes, so I'm panicking. I run down there, and my poor husband is crouched next to the car. The engine is running. He's got the mason jar over the exhaust pipe, and he looks at me, and he says, "They won't die." And the baby bat has his eyes kind of rolling, and then the big bat is sort of fluttering the wings just barely. And I mean, it's just horrible, but our daughter's life is at stake, and we don't know what to do. And my husband's always been a creative thinker, and suddenly his face lights up and he yells, "We'll nuke them in the microwave." And he jumps up and runs into the kitchen. And I admit, my first thought was, I'm buying a new microwave. But we got in there, and he turned the power on, and the bats died. He grabbed the jar and raced off to get to the bus terminal. And then waiting for the results was just the worst. Just waiting. It was horrible. But like all Hallmark commercials, it was good news. The bats did not have rabies, and so my daughter was going to be okay. And for anyone that likes facts, it takes 8 seconds to kill a bat in the microwave.
Silvana Clark lives in Bellingham. That's it for our show today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Monica Spain. Our intern is Janae Janik, and we had help this week from Brett Hamill and Bellamy Palethorpe. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. If you could use another podcast in your life, try ours. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your audio, including your smart speaker. We also love to get your feedback on Facebook or email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week when we'll venture into sacred spaces. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.